Welcome, deeply curious listener, to the deep dive. Imagine a sound. It's both rhinestone cowboy country and gritty soulful rock and roll, all wrapped up in one impossibly cool, tragically short life.
Right.
A sound so unique, its creator actually had to give it its own name, Cosmic American Music. Today, we're undertaking an immersive deep dive into the extraordinary, well, enigmatic and often heartbreaking story of Gram Parsons.
Yeah, quite a story.
Critics like Stephen Thomas Erlewine have called him enormously influential, a figure revered by rock legends from Keith Richards to Emmylou Harris. Yet, as Richards himself noted, his recorded output was, well, pretty minimal.
It really was, surprisingly so.
So how does an artist with minimal records achieve such legendary status and fundamentally reshape the very landscape of American music?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Our mission today is to thoroughly unpack the complex, brief, but incredibly impactful life of Ingram Cecil Connor III, better known to the world, of course, as Gram Parsons. We'll explore how he forged that genre-blurring sound, delve deep into his personal struggles, examine his profound connections to some of music's biggest names, and trace his enduring, almost mythical legacy.
Right.
We want to understand why, despite a career cut tragically short at just 26 years old, he's considered such a pivotal artist who, well, changed everything.
And to guide us through this rich tapestry, we've pulled together a diverse collection of sources. We've got detailed biographical accounts, insightful album reviews, comprehensive band histories, deeply personal anecdotes from those who knew him best, and critical discussions analyzing his lasting influence.
So this isn't just a list of facts.
No, not at all. It's an intellectual and emotional journey through a life that burned with this, you know, incandescent light, leaving an indelible mark on American culture.
The formative years, a Southern Gothic start.
Let's begin at the very beginning, shall we? Born Ingram Cecil Connor III on November 5, 1946 in Winter Haven, Florida, Parsons had one sibling, sister named Little Avis.
But if you were to just look at his family's surface, you might assume it was a quintessential Southern upbringing, you know, steeped in privilege.
Indeed, that initial perception is precisely what makes his early life so compellingly contradictory. Here's what's so striking. Parsons came from a background of immense wealth and social standing.
Right.
His father, Ingram Cecil Connor II, known by the colorful nickname Coondog, was a decorated World War II flying ace, recipient of the Air Medal, and worked for his father-in-law's substantial company.
Okay.
And that father-in-law, none other than citrus magnate John A. Snively, who owned vast properties across Florida and in Waycross, Georgia, where the Connors primarily resided.
Wow.
So by all outward measures, we're talking about a family of considerable means with all the trappings of Southern aristocracy.
Right, but beneath that polished, affluent exterior, there was this profound current of pain and instability. Both his parents, Ingram Cecil Connor II and Avis Snively Connor, struggled deeply with alcoholism and depression. This wasn't just a minor detail in his childhood. It was a defining, critical piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely.
That shaped his early environment and, arguably, cast a long shadow over his entire life and artistic temperament.
Absolutely. When we connect this to the broader context of his development, you can see a young life marked by a series of truly profound tragedies.
Yeah.
His father, Cecil II, committed suicide on December 23, 1958, when Parsons was a mere 12 years old.
12. Just imagine.
Imagine the seismic impact of such a loss, especially at that incredibly formative age. His mother, Avis, then married Robert Parsons, whose surname Gram and his sister subsequently adopted.
Right, so that's where the name comes from.
Exactly, giving him the iconic name Gram Parsons that wasn't his by birth.
And the tragedies, heartbreakingly, continue to pile up. His mother, Avis herself, died of complications from alcoholism on his high school graduation day, June 5th, 1965.
Graduation day.
What a devastating, bittersweet culmination to his adolescence, a day meant for celebration turned into another day of profound loss.
Yeah.
Adding to this instability, his stepfather, Robert Parsons, remarried shortly after her death.
This leads us to a crucial question for understanding his artistic path. How do such tumultuous formative years, laden with deep personal loss and familial instability, combined with a significant degree of financial freedom, fundamentally shape an artist? Parsons attended the prestigious Ball School in Jacksonville, then Winter Haven High School, and even briefly attended Harvard University for a semester.
Well, right.
But the game changer arrived at age 21, when he began receiving an annual trust fund income of $30,000.
Which back then was?
Oh, in the late 1960s, that was an absolutely considerable sum. It granted him immense independence to pursue his artistic vision without the immediate pressures of commercial success. This financial cushion, while allowing him to explore his art without compromise, also, ironically, may have enabled some of his more self-destructive tendencies by removing the conventional safeguards of needing to work for a living.
That financial freedom certainly gave him the liberty to chase his muse, leading him down paths that were anything but conventional. But the first spark of that muse, the very inception of his musical journey, ignited remarkably early, didn't it?
It did indeed. Parsons developed strong musical interests very early on, a passion seemingly ignited by the sheer spectacle of seeing Elvis Presley perform live.
Elvis, of course.
In concert in Waycross, Georgia, on February 23, 1956. This wasn't just a concert. It was an epiphany for a young boy.
Yeah.
Just 5 years later, by the time he was 16, he was already playing in local rock and roll cover bands like the Pacers and the Legends, often headlining in his stepfather's clubs in Winter Haven.
Already performing.
He wasn't just a casual participant. He was an active performer, soaking up the energy of live music.
So he started with that raw, electric energy of rock and roll. But his musical journey, even in those early years, evolved with astonishing speed.
Yes. By 1963, he had gravitated towards the more acoustic, storytelling traditions of folk music, forming his first truly professional outfit, the Shilohs.
The Shilohs, okay.
Heavily influenced by popular folk acts of the era like the Kingston Trio and the Journeymen, the Shilohs performed in hootenannies, intimate coffee houses, and high school auditoriums.
Mm-hmm.
They even ventured into the vibrant folk scene of New York City, performing at Florida's exhibition in the 1964 New York World's Fair and making regular appearances at the legendary Cafe Raffio on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village.
Wow, right into the heart of it.
There was even an exploratory meeting with the legendary impresario Albert Grossman, who managed Bob Dylan.
Grossman.
Though Grossman famously balked at booking them for a Christmas engagement at the bitter end, once he discovered they were still just high school students.
Huh. That's a quintessential music industry anecdote right there, perfectly illustrating the blend of ambition and youthful naivety. But it certainly underscores his early drive and clear trajectory towards a musical career.
Absolutely. The group ultimately dissolved in the spring of 1965, reaching a creative impasse amidst the electrifying emergence of folk rock.
Right, things were changing fast then.
This rapid evolution of his musical tastes, from the raw energy of early rock and roll to the narrative depth of folk, was laying the crucial groundwork for his groundbreaking, genre-blending future. Even during these brief, often tumultuous early years, Parsons was a sponge, absorbing everything around him and beginning to synthesize what would become his truly unique sound, too. The genesis of cosmic American music, early bands, and vision.
That rapid evolution continued to accelerate, and by 1966, Parsons was truly starting to put his unique musical vision into concrete action. He teamed up with other musicians from the bustling Boston folk scene to form a group called the International Submarine Band. They briefly resided in the Bronx before making the crucial move to Los Angeles in 1967. This relocation to the West Coast wasn't just a change of scenery, was it? It was a significant strategic step.
It was absolutely pivotal. This period marks a profound transition as Parsons actively began to forge what would become his distinctive signature sound.
Yeah.
It's here, in the vibrant, experimental melting pot of the burgeoning L.A. music scene, that the nascent idea of cosmic American music truly begins to take coherent shape.
Right.
He was synthesizing all those rich early influences from the raw power of Elvis to the narrative depth of folk and pushing them into entirely new, unexplored sonic territory. He was essentially, reverse engineering American music, taking its disparate threads and weaving them into something entirely new.
The International Submarine Band, while not achieving widespread commercial fame, certainly laid some incredibly important groundwork for Parsons' future. They signed with Lee Hazelwood's LHI Records and spent late 1967 recording their album, Safe at Home.
That album is absolutely fascinating early artifact, a true blueprint. It contains one of Parsons' best-known songs, the propulsive luxury liner, and an early raw version of Do You Know How It Feels?, which he would later refine and revisit in his career.
Oh, okay.
The compelling aspect here is how Safe at Home serves as a crucial precursor to his more famous, influential works, powerfully showcasing his nascent songwriting prowess and an emerging, sophisticated blend of genres that was distinctly his own.
Hi.
However, in a twist typical of Parsons' early career, the album wouldn't even be released until mid-1968, by which time the International Submarine Band had already broken up.
Classic.
It was a vision ahead of its time, even for the labels.
And in a quirky footnote, they even made an appearance in a very zeitgeisty film of the era, didn't they?
They did indeed. The International Submarine Band appeared in Peter Fonda's Counterculture 1967 film, The Trip, performing as a live act in one of the club scenes.
You trip. Wow.
Their song Lazy Days was even offered for the film's soundtrack. And in a rather interesting side note that highlights Parsons' immediate impact on other artists, Peter Fonda himself recorded a version of Parsons' beautiful ballad November Nights as a single in March 1967.
Fonda recorded his song. Interesting.
So, even amidst these early struggles, there were undeniable hints of the unique influence and respect he would command from creative figures around him. But you can see how commercial success remained elusive, while the foundational elements of his sound were clearly emerging without immediate widespread recognition.
So we keep coming back to this evocative term, cosmic American music. Parsons coined it himself, describing it as his personal hybrid of country, rhythm and blues, soul, folk, and rock.
Mm-hmm.
He's widely credited with not just contributing to, but actively helping to found the country rock and later the alt-country genres.
This brings us to an essential question. What exactly made this cosmic American music so profoundly revolutionary? It wasn't merely a superficial act of mixing genres, like a musical salad. It was about something far deeper, a spiritual and emotional synthesis. Parsons sought to unearth the authentic, often melancholic soul embedded within country music,
mm-hmm.
to infuse it with the raw, visceral grit of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And to then synthesize these seemingly disparate elements with the yearning, gospel-infused power of rhythm and blues and soul. He was looking for a sound that could capture the entire sprawling breadth of American musical traditions,
mm-hmm.
from the deep rural South to the electric rock stages of the cities.
That's a huge scope.
Think about it this way. He wasn't just adding a pedal steel to a rock song. He was blending lyrical themes of classic country heartbreak and longing with the driving rhythms and electric instrumentation of rock, often delivered with a soulful, almost gospel-like vocal conviction.
Mm-hmm.
He'd pair traditional country harmonies with unexpected chord changes or infuse a classic R&B groove with a twangy guitar lick. This vision was undoubtedly ahead of its time, which strongly helps to explain why it didn't find immediate widespread commercial success.
Right. People weren't ready.
The music industry and many audiences simply weren't ready for such a radical yet organic fusion. But it was profoundly influential, creating a foundational blueprint for countless future generations of artists who sought to push boundaries, ignore genre definitions, and forge entirely new musical categories. He essentially created a new language for American popular music. 3, the Byrds and the shift to country rock.
So the International Submarine Band dissolved, but Parsons' raw, undeniable talent wasn't going unnoticed for long. By February 1968, he caught the attention of Chris Hillman, the bassist for one of the era's most iconic bands, the Byrds.
The Byrds, yeah. Huge deal.
Hillman was actively looking for new members after the departures of David Crosby and Michael Clark. Hillman initially recruited Parsons, believe it or not, as a jazz pianist.
As a jazz pianist, which is amazing. What's truly remarkable here is how swiftly Parsons transcended that initial, relatively narrow role. He almost immediately began contributing rhythm guitar and vocals to the band.
Right away.
Effortlessly showcasing his incredible versatility, natural musicality, and magnetic stage presence. However, this period also eliminates some complex internal dynamics within the Byrds.
Uh-huh.
While Parsons was, by all accounts, an equal contributor creatively,
mm-hmm.
bringing a fresh visionary energy, he wasn't officially regarded as a full member by Columbia Records.
Oh, really?
He was instead hired as a sideman on a salary, a legalistic distinction that would cause him considerable frustration.
So here he was, bringing this incredible, genre-defying musical vision to an already established band, but contractually and institutionally, he wasn't an equal partner.
Exactly.
Parsons himself reflected on this tension, saying, "Being with the Byrds confused me a little. I couldn't find my place. I didn't have enough say-so. I really wasn't one of the Byrds."
Wow.
"I was originally hired because they wanted a keyboard player, but I had experience being a frontman, and that came out immediately. And Roger McGuinn, being a very perceptive fellow, saw that it would help the act, and he started sticking me out front."
That candid reflection speaks volumes about his ambition, his inherent leadership, and the underlying tensions of that collaboration.
It absolutely does. And this complex dynamic ultimately led to what is arguably one of the most pivotal and groundbreaking albums in the entire history of country rock, Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
A sweetheart, yeah.
Roger McGuinn's initial concept for the album was incredibly ambitious. He envisioned a sprawling double album history of American popular music, tracing its evolution from bluegrass to country, jazz, R&B, rock, and even venturing into electronic music.
Which sounds like a very McGuinn idea.
Right. But Parsons, with his burgeoning cosmic American music vision, had a far more focused and ultimately revolutionary idea that completely redirected the Byrds' trajectory.
He did, and it took immense persuasive power. Parsons successfully convinced the other band members to abandon Los Angeles and travel to Nashville.
Nashville.
The very heart of country music, to record the album. This move effectively jettisoned McGuinn's expansive academic concept in favor of a singular, full-on country project.
Wow.
The album became a showcase for Parsons' own evolving songwriting, featuring his poignant originals like 100 Years From Now and Hickory Wind, alongside his evocative interpretations of songs by seminal figures like Bob Dylan, Woody Guthrie, and Merle Haggard.
Let's really unpack this for you, the listener, because Sweetheart at the Rodeo is consistently cited as a foundational text for country rock, an album that changed the game. Why is its significance so immense?
Its profound impact cannot be overstated. Parsons' influence here was nothing short of transformative. He quite literally steered one of rock's biggest and most innovative psychedelic bands, famous for tracks like 8 Miles High, into completely uncharted territory.
Right into country.
Directly into the heart of traditional country music. This was audacious, a genuine culture clash. He introduced a raw, authentic country sensibility, utilizing pedal steel guitar in a rock context, blending those twangy melodies with folk rock harmonies and injecting traditional country narrative structures into the Byrd sound. For critics and contemporary musicians, it was a shock, a daring artistic statement that many didn't quite grasp at the time. It was too country for most rock audiences and too rock for traditional country purists.
Caught between worlds.
Exactly. Yet, it laid the very groundwork for what would become country rock, creating a sonic bridge that countless artists would later cross. However, there were immediate frustrating legal challenges.
Ah, the LHI contract.
Precisely. Parsons was still under contract to Lee Hazlewood's LHI Records, and Hazlewood threatened a lawsuit over Parsons' prominent vocal contributions to the album.
Oh, no.
As a result, in a painful compromise, Roger McGuinn replaced 3 of Parsons' lead vocals with his own. Parsons later expressed his profound frustration, stating McGuinn erased it and did the vocals himself and fucked it up.
Ouch.
Despite this setback, Parsons remained as lead vocalist on essential tracks like You Still On My Mind, Life in Prison, and of course, The Haunting Hickory Wind. It was a powerful, if somewhat compromised, statement, leaving us to wonder what an unadulterated Parsons-led Byrds album might have sounded like.
So this groundbreaking album, a true turning point, also sets the stage for a dramatic, principled exit. Parsons left the Byrds in the summer of 1968 while they were in England.
Yeah.
The reason being his firm moral opposition to their planned concert tour of apartheid-era South Africa.
Wow. Okay, that's significant. This is truly a pivotal moment where the story takes a fascinating turn. This departure wasn't just about a band breaking up over musical differences. It was a powerful demonstration of Parsons' deep-seated principles, which is not something he's always given credit for.
No, definitely not.
And it leads directly to one of the most famous and influential friendships in rock history. During this period in England, Parsons became deeply acquainted with Mick Jagger and, more importantly, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones.
The Stones connection, right.
Parsons actually stayed at Richards Redlands' country estate, and the two developed a remarkably close, almost symbiotic friendship.
Mm-hmm.
This connection profoundly cemented Parsons' influence within the rock pantheon because he is widely credited with literally reintroducing the guitarist to country music.
Really? Reintroducing Keith Richards?
Yeah. For Richards, who was already steeped in blues, rock, and R&B, Parsons opened up an entirely new world of American roots music. He introduced Richards to legendary country artists like George Jones, Merle Haggard, and Hank Williams.
The greats.
Playing their records, breaking down their chord structures, and sharing the deep emotional resonance of their lyrics. This anecdote alone of Parsons showing Keith Richards the very roots of American country music is incredibly powerful.
Absolutely.
It's a key reason why you hear those country-infused textures and lyrical themes start appearing in Stones albums like Beggar's Banquet and especially Exile on Main Street. Richards himself would later say, "Graham was a great inspiration, and his effect on country music is enormous. It wasn't just influence. It was a deep artistic exchange."
Yeah.
4. the Flying Burrito Brothers, the vision crystallized.
Parsons eventually returned to Los Angeles, and what happened next truly represented the crystallization of his cosmic American music vision. He sought out his former Birds bandmate, Chris Hillman.
Yelm again.
And together they formed the Flying Burrito Brothers, bringing in bassist Chris Etheridge and the legendary pedal steel player, Sneaky Pete Kleinow, who would become synonymous with their sound.
Sneaky Pete, mm-hmm. Yes. What's particularly striking here is how The Gilded Palace of Sin, their 1969 debut album, became this definitive, undeniable statement. Mm-hmm. Critics consistently describe it as the culmination of Parsons' post-1966 musical vision, a modernized variant of the Bakersfield sound, amalgamated with strands of soul and psychedelic rock. This wasn't just a new band. It was a musical manifesto, boldly declaring a new direction for American music.
And the cover.
The album cover itself was a deliberate, audacious statement. The band appeared in custom nudie suits, but these weren't just any nudie suits. They were emblazoned with flamboyant hippie symbols, including patches inspired by marijuana, tunnel, and secondal. A visual representation of their genre-bending counterculture spirit, merging outlaw country aesthetics with psychedelic excess.
And the music contained within was just as daring and boundary-pushing as that album cover, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The album included brilliant Parsons Hillman originals, like the infectious Christine's tune, Devil in Disguise, and the haunting Sin City, showcasing their incredibly productive and empathetic songwriting partnership.
Great song.
But they also bravely and brilliantly tackled soul music classics, such as Aretha Franklin's The Dark End of the Street and Do Right Woman, Do Right Man, the latter even featuring David Crosby on high harmony.
Crosby, too.
Yeah. The pronounced gospel soul influence woven throughout the album likely evolved from the eclectic tastes of bassist Chris Etheridge, who also co-wrote poignant tracks like Hot Burrito No. 1, I'm Your Toy, mm-hmm. and Hot Burrito No. 2 with Parsons. It was a definitive blueprint for everything that would follow in country rock and alt country, a seamless fusion that felt both timeless and utterly fresh. Robert Christgau, the renowned critic, famously called it an ominous, obsessive, tongue-in-cheek country rock synthesis, absorbing rural and urban, traditional and contemporary at point of impact.
That captures it perfectly.
He perfectly captured its subversive yet authentic spirit.
It sounds like an absolutely groundbreaking work, a true masterpiece of fusion. Yet, but despite its critical acclaim, it wasn't a commercial success, was it?
Unfortunately, no. The Gilded Palace of Sin was commercially unsuccessful, a common fate for music that's simply too far ahead of its time.
Yeah.
The band faced numerous, often chaotic, touring challenges. Parsons, famously plagued by a severe fear of flying, insisted they often tour by train across the country.
By train.
These train journeys reportedly became rolling poker games, with band members often losing most of their meager earnings. Their concerts were frequented with utter bewilderment from audiences who simply didn't quite know what to make of this genre-defying hybrid sound.
Like we said, too country for rock, too rock for country.
Exactly. Add to this the increasing use of psilocybin and cocaine by Parsons, which frequently led to erratic, unpredictable, and sometimes brilliant, sometimes disastrous performances.
But even amidst those struggles and the commercial indifference, there were powerful glimpses of their live potential, weren't there?
Indeed. One of their more successful and memorable appearances was in Philadelphia, where they opened for the reconstituted Birds. Midway through their set, Parsons, with his signature audacity, joined his former group on stage, fronting them on powerful renditions of Hickory Wind and You Don't Miss Your Water. This illustrates a larger truth. Here was a band, despite its commercial struggles ahead of its time, pushing boundaries and struggling to find its audience in a music landscape not yet fully prepared for its bold, honest synthesis.
Despite the initial commercial flop, they quickly put out a second album. After the Gilded Palace of Sin's underperformance, and with Chris Etheridge departing, reportedly because his tastes didn't align with Parsons and Hillman's deepening affinity for country music, Bernie Lydon joined on lead guitar, and Hillman reverted to bass.
Bernie Lydon,
yes.
Right. Leader of the Eagles.
Exactly.
Faced with a critical dearth of new material and an extremely reduced budget, Burrito Deluxe was hastily recorded and released in April 1970.
Hastily done.
Much of the album was written on the fly, sometimes in the studio itself. While it's generally considered less inspired than its groundbreaking predecessor, it is notable for the Parsons-Hillman composition Older Guys, and significantly for the band's poignant take on the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses.
Ah, Wild Horses.
Which the Stones had just recorded and given to Parsons to release first as a single. This album, too, underperformed commercially and, crucially, failed to capture the same critical cachet as their debut.
And this is where Parsons' personal struggles with addiction really started to overshadow and perhaps even compromise his undeniable musical output, isn't it?
This raises an important question. To what extent did his escalating personal struggles and intensifying drug use impact his artistic output and focus, especially during this period? By this time, Parsons' use of various substances had increased significantly.
Mm-hmm.
He spent much of his time partying with the Rolling Stones, who were in America finishing Let It Bleed. While the Stones played to massive, adoring venues, the Flying Burrito Brothers found themselves playing to dwindling nightclub audiences.
Oof, tough contrast.
A stark contrast that must have been incredibly frustrating. Though it's worth noting, they were booked as one of the acts at the infamous Altamont Music Festival.
Altamont, wow.
Playing a short set that included Boney Maroney and 6 Days on the Road, a performance captured in the event's chilling documentary, Gimme Shelter.
So Burrito Deluxe truly marked the beginning of the end for his active participation in established bands, pointing towards a more solitary and tumultuous path.
Yes, exactly. Disenchanted and increasingly erratic, Parsons left the Flying Burrito Brothers by mutual agreement with Hillman.
Okay.
This decision marked the beginning of a more tumultuous solo path, one heavily characterized by declining musical output amidst mounting personal struggles with addiction and lifestyle choices. It's a poignant moment in his career, as his singular vision, so beautifully crystallized and powerfully realized in the Gilded Palace of Sin, began to fray under the relentless weight of his personal demons and the pressures of an industry that didn't quite know what to do with his genius. V-Solo Endeavors, Emmylou Harris, and A New Direction.
After leaving the Flying Burrito Brothers, Parsons immediately tried to launch a solo career. In early 1970, he signed a solo deal with A&M Records and even moved in with acclaimed producer Terry Melcher.
Melcher, yeah.
Big name. But these sessions were, by all accounts, largely unproductive, weren't they? It sounds like a missed opportunity.
Sadly, it was a truly tragic missed opportunity, and this period vividly illustrates the double-edged sword of his rock star connections. While Parsons had unprecedented access to legendary artists and producers, he was also deeply entangled in a destructive lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Both Parsons and Melcher shared a penchant for cocaine and heroin, creating an environment antithetical to productive creativity.
Not a good mix.
As a direct result, the sessions were largely unproductive, chaotic, and unfocused, with Parsons eventually losing interest in the entire project. The master tapes for that ill-fated A&M album were ultimately lost.
Lost. Oh, man.
A heartbreaking testament to the chaos and squandered potential at that time.
He also spent a significant amount of time with the Rolling Stones again during this particularly turbulent period, didn't he?
He did. Parsons accompanied the Rolling Stones on their 1971 UK tour, reportedly harboring hopes of being signed to the newly formed Rolling Stones Records.
Ah, okay.
He even lived at Keith Richards' picturesque French villa, Nelcote, during the infamous recording sessions for Exile on Main Street.
Nelcote, legendary sessions.
While his physical presence was undeniable, he contributed little to the actual musical process, as his escalating drug use and constant public quarreling with his then-girlfriend, Gretchen Burrell, created a disruptive atmosphere.
Mm.
This eventually led to his expulsion from the villa by Richard's formidable girlfriend, Anita Pallenberg.
Kicked out by Anita Pallenberg.
Yeah. He later attempted to rekindle his relationship with the band on their 1972 American tour, but to no avail. It's a powerful narrative of being in close proximity to creative greatness and immense excess, and tragically, the devastating consequences that often accompany such a lifestyle.
But then a truly pivotal, almost miraculous moment arrived that would forever alter the course of his legacy. Parsons returned to the U.S. for a one-off concert with the Burritos, and in Washington, D.C., he met a then-unknown singer named Emmylou Harris.
Emmylou, yes. The pivotal nature of this partnership truly comes into focus here. Parsons recognized something extraordinary in Harris's voice and asked her to join him in Los Angeles to record his first solo album. Her acceptance would prove to be absolutely crucial, not just for his upcoming solo records, but for his entire posthumous legacy. Harris became far more than just a duet partner. She evolved into a crucial interpreter, a tireless champion, and ultimately a guardian of his music,
right,
ensuring its longevity and wider recognition far beyond his lifetime. Her pure, crystalline soprano provided a perfect, almost angelic vocal foil to Parsons' raw, expressive, and often fragile tenor, elevating his performances to new, emotionally resonant heights.
That blend is just incredible.
She was, in many ways, the artistic anchor he so desperately needed, both musically and personally.
And this momentous meeting directly led to his official solo debut, the critically acclaimed album GP.
Yes. It came as a surprise to many in the industry when Parsons, despite his recent tumultuous history, was signed to Reprise Records by the perceptive Mo Austin in mid-1972.
Mo Austin.
The ensuing album GP, released in 1973, featured several members of Elvis Presley's legendary TCB band.
Elvis's band.
Lending it an incredibly solid, professional musical foundation. It showcased six powerful new songs from Parsons, alongside his heartfelt interpretations of classic country covers, like Tom Paul Glazer's Streets of Baltimore and George Jones's. That's all it took.
Great choices.
While GP did manage to chart, it clearly represented a more focused, disciplined effort, backed by seasoned musicians who could fully realize his vision. It demonstrated his continued, unwavering commitment to his unique musical aesthetic, even after all the previous setbacks and personal turmoil.
Yeah, it feels different.
This period prompts us to consider how an artist's vision can continue to evolve, finding renewed clarity and dedication even amidst ongoing personal chaos.
To support GP and finally bring his cosmic American music to wider audiences, Parsons and Harris embarked on a tour across the U.S. as Graham Parsons and the Fallen Angels in February and March of 1973.
And this is truly captivating, because this tour wasn't just about performing music. It was about the forging of a legendary, almost mythical partnership that would reverberate through music history. Unable to afford the full TCB band, the touring group featured talented guitarists Jock Bartley and Larry Corio, the indispensable Neil Flans on pedal steel, bassist Kyle Tullis, and drummer Andy Smart.
Solid lineup.
The touring party also included Parsons' new wife, Gretchen, who, adding another layer of tension, was reportedly quite envious of Harris's growing closeness to Graham.
Oh, awkward.
Coordinating this entire, often chaotic spectacle as road manager was Phil Kaufman.
Phil Kaufman again.
A truly fascinating character who had notably served time with Charles Manson on Terminal Island. Kaufman was given the unenviable task of trying to keep Parsons clean and limiting his alcohol intake, particularly during shows.
That's quite a detail about Phil Kaufman, with that unique background, being tasked with managing Graham Parsons' sobriety on the road.
It's an incredible, almost cinematic detail. Initially, the band was under-rehearsed and often played poorly, reflecting the chaotic nature of Parsons' life.
Right.
But they improved significantly with steady gigging, evolving into a tight, powerful unit. They received rapturous responses at several iconic countercultural venues across the country, including the Armillo World Headquarters in Austin, Max's Kansas City in New York City.
Legendary venues.
And Liberty Hall in Houston, where none other than Neil Young and Linda Ronstadt famously sat in for a film performance.
Neil Young and Linda Ronstadt sat in.
Wow. Despite these passionate live receptions, the tour frustratingly failed to galvanize sales of GP, which never charted in the Billboard 200. Still, it powerfully highlights the raw talent, undeniable vocal chemistry, and immense potential of Parsons and Harris as a duo, truly capturing the essence of his cosmic American music live for those fortunate enough to witness it.
And then came his final album, Grievous Angel, which was posthumously released in 1974. This album often feels like both the culmination and a tragic what-if in his career.
What's truly poignant here is the profound sense of what could have been. For this final album, Parsons again featured Emmylou Harris as his essential duet partner and brought back key members of the TCB band, providing that rock-solid musical backbone.
Mm-hmm.
The record received significantly more enthusiastic reviews than GP, and though modest in its achievement, it actually peaked at number 195 on the Billboard chart.
It charted, finally.
Indicating a slowly growing, albeit tragically belated, recognition for his work. Parsons only contributed two new songs, the deeply personal In My Hour of Darkness and the poetic Return of the Grievous Angel. But he was reportedly genuinely enthusiastic about the sessions and seemed to have finally adopted a diligent mindset toward his musical career.
He was getting it together.
Significantly limiting his intake of alcohol and opiates during most of the recording. It's often considered his finest, most cohesive work, a truly tragic testament to an immense talent on the very cusp of fully realizing his potential, cut short just as he seemed to be finding his focus and his footing. It felt like the clouds might finally be parting for him. 6. Personal life and tragic end.
As we delve deeper, it becomes abundantly clear that Parsons' personal life was every bit as complex, contradictory, and ultimately tumultuous as his groundbreaking musical journey. In 1971, he married Gretchen Burrell at his stepfather's grand estate in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
For a brief period, it genuinely seemed like he might finally find some semblance of stability, a safe harbor from the storm.
There were certainly fleeting moments of it, yes. Parsons and Burrell briefly relocated to England, where, with the sincere help and support of his friends Rick Gretsch and Hank Wangford, Parsons reportedly managed to stop using heroin for a period.
Okay, that's hopeful.
This offers a rare, hopeful glimpse into his capacity for change and his desire for a healthier life, however temporary. However, his personal life was also marked by other profound complexities, including the existence of a daughter, Polly Parsons, who was born in 1967 to Nancy Ross.
Right, his daughter Polly.
This raises an important question. How do these intense personal dynamics, these tantalizing glimpses of stability, the undeniable responsibilities of fatherhood, and his recurring struggles with addiction intertwine and ultimately play into his artistic narrative and his public persona?
Yeah.
In the summer of 1973, a tragic accident occurred. A stray cigarette caused his Topanga Canyon home to burn entirely to the ground, destroying most of his possessions, including many treasured personal effects and instruments.
Oh, devastating.
This devastating fire proved to be the last straw in his already strained relationship with Burrell, and he subsequently moved into a spare room at Phil Kaufman's house, rekindling a relationship with his high school sweetheart, Margaret Fisher.
Back with Margaret Fisher. Okay. And then we arrive at Joshua Tree, a starkly beautiful, almost mystical desert landscape that became deeply, irrevocably intertwined with his story, serving both as a spiritual retreat and ultimately the haunting scene of his final moments.
What's absolutely fascinating here is how Joshua Tree became this almost mythic, deeply personal space for Parsons. Beginning in the late 1960s, he frequently vacationed at Joshua Tree National Monument, finding a unique solace and inspiration in its stark, otherworldly beauty.
Yeah, it has that quality.
It was a place where he openly experimented with psychedelics and famously claimed to have experienced UFO sightings.
UFOs.
Feeding into his cosmic American music persona. After his separation from Burrell, he often spent weekends there with Margaret Fisher and his loyal road manager, Phil Kaufman. It transformed into a place of both profound retreat and dangerous indulgence, a fittingly mystical and desolate backdrop for the final tragic chapter of his story.
And that end came very suddenly, and in a way that will become one of the most infamous and bizarre stories in the annals of rock and roll history.
And this is where Graham Parsons' narrative takes on an almost mythical quality, as his final moments become as legendary as his music itself. Scheduled to resume touring in October 1973, Parsons decided on another recuperative excursion to Joshua Tree, seeking its unique desert solace on September 17th.
Right before the tour.
Accompanying him were Margaret Fisher, his assistant Michael Martin, and Martin's girlfriend Dale McElroy. On both nights of their stay, Parsons retreated further into the desert landscape, consuming copious amounts of alcohol and barbiturates.
Not good.
On September 18th, Martin drove back to Los Angeles to resupply the group with marijuana. That night, Parsons recklessly challenged Fisher and McElroy to drink with him, but they wisely declined. Parsons, ever defiant, declared he would drink for the three of them, consuming an alarming 6 double tequilas.
6 doubles. Wow.
And then the situation tragically spiraled out of control.
Yeah.
It did. The three then went to the Joshua Tree Inn, where Parsons, with chilling ease, purchased morphine from an unknown woman.
Just bought morphine.
After being injected by her in room #1, he tragically, fatally overdosed. Fisher, in a desperate attempt to revive him, gave him an ice cube suppository, then a cold shower, and moved him to room #8, hoping for a change of fortune.
Trying anything.
She then left McElroy to stand guard while she went to buy coffee, clinging to a desperate hope of reviving him with caffeine. As Parsons' breathing became increasingly irregular and then abruptly ceased, McElroy attempted resuscitation. But after all frantic attempts failed, they finally called an ambulance.
Too late.
Parsons was tragically declared dead on arrival at Yucca Valley Hospital at 12:15 a.m. on September 19, 1973, aged just 26 years old.
26. Just unbelievable.
The official cause of death was recorded as an overdose of morphine and alcohol.
Yeah.
In a grimly pragmatic detail, Phil Kaufman then drove Fisher and McElroy back to Los Angeles and, notably, dispersed the remaining drugs in the desert.
Getting rid of the evidence.
Perhaps to protect his friends from further legal trouble.
But the story, unbelievably, doesn't end there. The events immediately following his death became just as legendary, if not more so, than aspects of his life.
Right.
Parsons had, with characteristic foresight, expressed a deeply personal final wish to his loyal friend Phil Kaufman to be cremated in Joshua Tree National Monument and have his ashes spread over Cap Rock, a sacred place to him.
Abrock.
However, his estranged stepfather had already arranged a private funeral ceremony in New Orleans and left Parsons' body in the care of a local funeral home.
So what does this extraordinary defiance of convention mean for understanding his enduring legend and the intense loyalty he inspired? To honor Parsons' fervent wishes, Kaufman, along with a friend, took matters into their own hands in an act of profound, if illegal, loyalty.
They stole the body.
They audaciously stole both a hearse and Parsons' body from the funeral home, embarking on a bizarre midnight road trip all the way back to Joshua Tree.
Incredible.
At Cap Rock parking lot under the vast desert sky, they poured gasoline into the open coffin and with the defiant flourish lit it, creating what witnesses described as an enormous fireball that lit up the desert night.
A fireball in the desert.
They were subsequently arrested and fined a mere $750 for stealing the coffin.
Only $750.
A small price, perhaps, for such a grand final gesture. What little remained of Parsons' body was then buried in the Garden of Memories Cemetery in Metairie, Louisiana, far from his spiritual resting place.
That's a truly bizarre, almost hyper-cinematic, and utterly unforgettable final act for an artist who lives so intensely. It's hard to imagine a more fittingly unconventional end to such an unconventional life.
It truly is. This extraordinary event is arguably one of the most famous or infamous stories in the entire history of rock and roll. It undeniably cemented Parsons' legend in the public consciousness, transforming his death into a myth as compelling as his music.
Yeah, it adds to the whole mystique.
The stark contrast between his deeply personal, unconventional final wishes and the bureaucratic official arrangements, combined with Kaufman's extreme, almost sacred act of loyalty, is a fascinating detail that encapsulates the wild, defiant, and unconventional spirit that defined Graham Parsons' life and ultimately his death.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, you still find his devoted fans visiting the Graham Parsons Memorial Hand Traverse at Joshua Tree, a makeshift memorial, though the Park Service has since removed a physical slab that marked his cremation, which is now the Joshua Tree Inn. Park guides are even given the option to tell this incredible, indelible story during their tours, underscoring its enduring power. Seven, enduring legacy and influence.
Despite his tragically short life and the minimal commercial success he experienced during his lifetime, Graham Parsons' influence has proven to be incredibly enduring, pervasive, and truly far-reaching.
Oh, absolutely.
Stephen Thomas Erlewine of AllMusic describes Parsons as enormously influential for both country and rock, stating unequivocally that he was blending the two genres to the point that they became indistinguishable from each other. His influence could still be heard well into the next millennium.
That sums it up pretty well.
Even Keith Richards, a man not given to hyperbole, noted that Parsons' effect on country music is enormous. And this is why we're talking about him now.
What's so profoundly striking here is that Parsons wasn't merely a talented musician. He was, in essence, a conceptual architect for entirely new genres of music.
Right.
His vision truly paved the way for countless artists who followed. He didn't just play country rock. He helped define its very essence and aesthetics. He fearlessly expanded the artistic possibilities of both country and rock music, building bridges where others saw insurmountable walls. His cosmic American music wasn't just a catchy phrase or a personal descriptor. It was a foundational philosophy, a template that allowed artists to draw from a wider, richer palette of American musical traditions, creating entirely new subgenres like alt country.
Yeah, alt country owes him a huge debt.
He basically opened the floodgates for authenticity, emotional honesty, and cross-pollination in popular music that continues to resonate and inspire new sounds even today. He made it acceptable, even cool, to be both a country purist and a rock and roller.
And that influence wasn't just theoretical or academic. It was deeply personal and inspirational for so many of his fellow musicians, particularly Emmylou Harris, who tirelessly continued to champion his work long after his untimely death.
When we connect this to the broader picture of artistic impact, it's clear his influence wasn't just academic. It was profoundly personal and deeply inspirational to countless other artists, ensuring his unique voice didn't fade away.
Right, she kept the flame alive.
Harris, with unwavering devotion, covered a significant number of his most beloved songs, including Hickory Wind, Wheels, Sin City, Luxury Liner, and Hot Burrito No. 2.
All classics.
Beyond direct covers, her own compositions, such as the heartbreaking Boulder to Birmingham from her iconic 1975 album Pieces of the Sky and the Road from her 2011 Albert Hard Bargain, are direct, heartfelt tributes to Parsons.
Older to Birmingham, yeah.
Even her critically acclaimed 1985 album The Ballad of Sally Rose contains many poignant allusions to him, proving her enduring dedication to his memory and music.
And she certainly wasn't the only one whose musical journey was touched by Parsons' brief but brilliant flame.
Not at all. The Eagles' poignant song, My Man, beautifully written by Bernie Leadon, is a direct emotional tribute to Gram Parsons.
Bernie Leadon again.
The 1973 album Crazy Eyes by the pioneering country rock band Poco also pays homage to Parsons, with Richie Furay composing the evocative title track specifically in his honor, and the band covering Parsons' moving brass buttons.
Poco too, right?
Beyond these direct tributes, his legacy has spawned a multitude of tribute albums, such as Commemorativo, a tribute to Gram Parsons, 1993, and the star-studded Return of the Grievous Angel, a tribute to Gram Parsons, 1999.
That one had everyone on it.
Which featured an incredible cast of artists, including Keith Richards, Lucinda Williams, Norah Jones, Steve Earle, and Dwight Yoakam. His truly unique story has also been immortalized in film documentaries like Gram Parsons, Fallen Angel, 2006, and even a farcical film, Grand Theft Parsons, 2003, starring Johnny Knoxville as Phil Kaufman.
Huh, the Kaufman movie.
Furthermore, musical theater productions, dedicated tribute bands, and annual festivals like Gram Fest and the Gram Parsons Guitar Pole and Tribute Festival in Waycross, Georgia, continue to celebrate his life and music today, nearly 50 years after his death.
And it's not just a historical legacy. His music and his profound relevance continue to be rediscovered and championed even now, decades later.
Absolutely. Yeah. A fantastic recent example that truly underscores his enduring relevance is the rediscovery and subsequent release in 2023 of the Last Roundup live tapes.
Oh, that live album, yeah.
This raw, electrifying recording features Emmylou Harris performing with Gram Parsons and the Fallen Angels, capturing their magical vocal chemistry live. Dave Prince, co-founder of Amoeba Music, initiated a passionate campaign to fund its independent release in partnership with Polly Parsons, Gram's daughter, ensuring this vital piece of his legacy saw the light of day.
Great, it finally came out.
This unearthed recording was considered one of the absolute hits of Record Store Day 2023, powerfully demonstrating the ongoing appetite for his music and its timeless appeal across generations.
Given this immense and widely recognized influence, this deep personal admiration from his peers, and the sustained critical reverence, you'd naturally think Gram Parsons would be enshrined in every major music hall of fame. But that's surprisingly not the case, is it?
This brings us to a really thought-provoking question about institutional recognition versus true artistic impact. Despite his undeniable widespread influence and the deep admiration of generations of musicians, Parsons has yet to be inducted into either the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or the Country Music Hall of Fame.
It's kind of shocking, really.
It's a striking paradox. There's even a dedicated Gram Parsons petition project, later renamed Gram Parsons International, launched in 2008, specifically to support his induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame, highlighting the public desire for this recognition.
People are still campaigning.
In 2003, the Americana Music Awards did posthumously honor Parsons with the prestigious President's Award, which his daughter accepted, a significant nod from a genre that he helped to invent and define.
Okay, so some recognition there.
But the continued absence of formal recognition from the two most prominent halls of fame for American popular music is a genuine point for critical reflection.
Why might this be?
Yeah, what's the reason?
Is it simply the brevity of his career, which saw him release only a handful of albums? Is it his profoundly genre-bending nature, which makes him difficult to neatly categorize into either rock or country boxes, perhaps frustrating purist voters in both camps?
Maybe too hard to label. Or could it be the unconventional, often self-destructive aspects of his personal life, overshadowing his musical achievements for some? It forces us to ask tough questions about the criteria for such honors and what we truly value when assessing an artist's legacy. Outro.
What an extraordinary journey we've taken today, but diving deeply into the complex life and profound legacy of Gram Parsons, from his tumultuous, privileged, yet tragic Southern Gothic beginnings, through his visionary creation of cosmic American music that seamlessly fused country, rock, soul, and folk, mm-hmm. to his pivotal, though often fraught, roles in The Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers, and his poignant, brief solo career revitalized by the remarkable Emmylou Harris Parsons, lived a life as intense, groundbreaking, and ultimately heartbreaking as his music.
Yeah.
His story is one of undeniable, prodigious talent, restless, relentless creativity, and heartbreaking personal struggles, culminating in that infamous, almost mythical final act in the stark beauty of Joshua Tree. He truly didn't just play American music. He fundamentally reshaped its very DNA.
Indeed. His undeniable widespread influence and the deep admiration he inspired in his peers and subsequent generations lead us to a final provocative thought for you, the listener. Given his undeniable widespread influence and the deep admiration he inspired in his peers and subsequent generations, what truly constitutes a legendary artist?
Right.
And why do some, like Graham Parsons, achieve that status, influencing so many, even without widespread commercial success or the institutional accolades that often signify mainstream greatness?
Good question.
What does his story, a life defined by creative genius, profound personal demons, and a brief, fiery existence, tell us about the true nature of artistic legacy? Is the ultimate measure of an artist's impact truly found in charts and awards, or is it in the lasting, indelible imprint they leave on the musical landscape and the hearts and minds of other artists, inspiring new sounds and pushing boundaries for generations to come?
Mm-hmm.
Graham Parsons' life and work compel us to ask these profound questions about the enduring power of art itself.